The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack from the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten, as it always is, by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. It's time to crack the cover in a brand new issue of Our State, celebrating North Carolina, this one for June 2019. We sure know it's summer, or almost officially summer, from the temperature outside recently. And so what a better time for Island Time, the theme of this month's issue. It's the annual coastal issue. They're calling it Island Time this year. And we'll be reading articles such as Castaways at Cape Lookout, and perhaps a local's guide to Ocracoke Island, boat-to-table dining in Nag's Head, and sea monkeys and sand dollars, Holden Beach memories. But you know how we always start the first of the month with the Welcome to Our State by Elizabeth Hudson, editor-in-chief. As good as it gets. There are menus I've saved, framed, and hung on the wall in my own kitchen like artwork. The ones printed on fancy textured cardstock and whose descriptions read like poetry. North Carolina yellowfin tuna, charred and encrusted in chili, in sesame and smoked sea salt. Oregon Inlet triggerfish with seared greens. Local red snapper topped with shaved radishes. Roll these words, chef words that I didn't know 20 years ago, 30 years ago, over and over on your tongue. Emulsion, mirepoix, tapenade, remoulade, vinaigrette, lemon brown butter, saffron, quinoa, capers, crème fraîche. I've had meals that have convinced me that North Carolina seafood chefs are wizards, concocting culinary magic in their kitchens. And then to the table here, the food comes as beautiful as it sounds, presented on bright white plates and looking just like summer. Vivid, ripe, with artful swirls of colorful sauces, strawberry and raspberry reds, dollops of frothy pesto, tendrils of tiny, leafy microgreens. I didn't know this food years ago, this contemporary interpretation of all that our ocean offers, and I'm grateful I found it now. These meals have enhanced and expanded my enjoyment of the coast. But I'd be remiss if I didn't also remember the menus I've kept, not on the wall, but imprinted on my memory. Dishes I can call out by heart, and I'll bet you remember them too. The oval platter from the breezeway at Topsail Beach, piled with perfectly fried flounder. You've got four choices here with seafood, broiled, grilled, fried, or steamed. And none of those are the wrong decision. And yes, this plate looks like summer, too. Fish, golden and crispy, salty and warm, sunshine yellow, lemon slices hugging the edge of the plate, hot hush puppies in a red plastic basket, cool tartar sauce in a squeeze bottle within arm's reach. After dinner, you grab a toothpick from the stainless steel dispenser on your way out and walk out back to the dock for the sunset over Banks Channel. And you'll set out again tomorrow, a determined plan to eat seafood every single day for the week you're at the beach. And that's not the wrong decision either. So many choices. How many times have you eaten the soft-shelled crabs at Sanitary Fish Market in Moorhead City? The crab cake sandwich at Salmon Omi's on Nag's Head? The shrimp burger wrapped in paper from Big Oak Drive-In? consuming the whole thing while leaning against the side of your car, using the hood as a makeshift table for your onion rings and chocolate shake. Think of those buckets of Hatteras Island little neck clams, pulled from Pamlico Sound, ready for steaming back at the house. And the stops at Mott's in Wilmington, or Captain Pete's Seafood Market in Holden Beach, the one under the bridge. Check the chalkboard for the daily catch, rockfish, mahi-mahi, grouper, perch, and let the woman with the curly red hair know what you want. Watch as she scoops tiny ice pellets into the bag, ties it up, and sends you on your way, your cooler full of fresh fish, and a reminder that fancy or simple, it doesn't get any better than this. And this is the annual coastal issue, Island Time. I'm going to read the introduction and then we'll do the pictorial. What a gift, those great shifting sandbars, a 325-mile-long string of them clustered up and down the Carolina coast, looming so large in the history of our state and in our lives, the bridges and ferries, the wild dunes and crashing waves, the beach houses and fish dinners. Year after year, we return to the islands. This is a wonderful picture. It says Bald Head Island was named for a sand dune, long since washed away, that mariners used as a landmark in the days before lighthouses. Today, family and friends stride along its golden beaches. This is really a tip of land here. Beach on both sides, coming around to the point, and then a little bit inland, oh, I don't know, 30 feet maybe? No, probably bigger than that, 50, 60 feet, something like that. Then some little dunes start, and a little bit of a dip where some water has gathered and formed a wonderful place to kids to splash around. And there's a few people walking on the beach here, and some wading in, and the waves are rippling in. Not really big, but they're frothy at the edges. It just looks wonderful. The greatest of all the shores I know are our long, sandy strands, the last sandbars before Africa, the islands of the Carolina coast. Whether we go out to them only a time or two, or steadily for 60 years, whether we find fish or first love or family life through the generations, the devotional, even reverential qualities of voice are in the air when we North Carolinians mention our jaunts, our stays at the beach, by which we mean the islands. What a gift of the gods to have been given time to look out and to stride endlessly upon them, to drift off at night and awaken in the morning to the sound of ocean waves crashing, to be in love out in this great wide open, to all but melt into the ocean-washed sands of islands with names like Bodie, Pea, and Hatteras, Ocracoke, Portsmouth, and Corbanks, Boguebanks, Bear, and Baldhead, Oak, Ocean Isle, and Bird. Even the litany of these few spoken aloud has about it the sound of a prayer. An answered prayer, indeed, for the millions of us who have been baptized by immersion in the foamy brine of breaking waves, knowing forever what it is like to long for blue crabs and salty oysters, and the balm of summer breezes off in the evening sea, and, too, the astringent winds out on the beach in late December, not merely laced, but fully laden with salt. Here's another picture of the beach. It's really a very simple picture. Sand, the waves crashing in a little bit of a time exposure here, so they look a little hazy. Then the ocean surface rolling out to the horizon, then blue, then streaks of the clouds leading up to the top of the picture where they are very small, puffy wisps of clouds. And the ones on the horizon have a slight bit of yellow and maybe orange in them. And that's because it's the evening. Evening breakers roll along Cape Hatteras National Seashore. And other pictures on here, it says kids bound up the 214 steps of the Currituck Beach Lighthouse. Paddle boards at a surf shop in Manteo await their next adventure. A foamy shell hash gathers collectible sea fragments. And get your tickets to the Carolina Beach Boardwalk Amusement Park here. So those are pictures of somebody going around that long spiral staircase in the Cape Hatteras National Seashore. On the Currituck Beach Lighthouse, and colorful paddle boards over there, and then of course the site of the it's kind of like a Ferris wheel, but two wheels that spin around, some people at one end, some at the other. They're all lit up in yellow against a dark blue sky. Because we literally taste the sea when we breathe, and taste, no less than music, unlocks the past, we could not stay the flood of seaside memories even if we wanted to. The gulls following the ferries from Cedar Island and Swan Quarter out to Ocracoke. The family car stuck in the sand way too close to the high tide line. A teenage driver looking in on the morning. The sweet soul music of the Tams filling the second floor dance floor hall of Nag's Head Casino while others played bingo down below. The sound of footsteps echoing off the spiraling iron stairs as pilgrims climbed up and down the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse. A 10-month-old taking her first steps in a tar paper fishing shack on the Corbanks strand above Drum Inlet. Older children joyfully crying out as they rounded the go-kart tracks, tire-rimmed curves at Atlantic Beach Circle. One cold November afternoon spent drift fishing, new topsail inlet for blues. The butterfly migration at Rich Inlet, thousands of them sleeping on the sea oats, each one climbing up the shaft and taking flight as the early summer morning warmed them. And farther south, the Fort Fisher Hermit, shaking his iron skillet at us, panhandling for coins. King mackerel steaks grilling and shrimp boiling away in a Bald Head Island kitchen. The telling and retelling of how Mr. Lockwood's newly finished ship drew too much water for it to get out from river to sea at the east end of Holden Beach. And sinking there gave Lockwood Folly Inlet its name. How well I recall the ritual crossings of Mad Inlet at low tide before it shoaled up and closed, from Sunset Beach to Bird Island, then walking about a mile toward Little River, and the very southern end of North Carolina, all the while searching for the soulful logbooks in the kindred spirit mailbox in the dunes. Well, before any of my millions of coastal memories formed, what a remarkable lot of people had already fetched up and lived their lives on these same spots over time. Land bridge pilgrims found their way across a whole continent and never stopped till they reached our coast. From March to October, ever after, they feasted on the islands like Huggins, inside Bogue Inlet and Roanoke Island, leaving acres of oyster shells and fish and turtle bones and the charred, buried remnants of their campfires at the one cheese thicket lump. Millennia before Ferris wheels and pavilions and shag dancing and pier fishing on Topsail and Nag's Head, Native Americans went to the islands to eat seafood and live simply and well. Year after year, we are borne back to the islands, our arms stretched out to the sea and to each other, the rhapsodies we share and reveries all our own. However well we know or think we know these glorious plain sandbars and their grassy dunes, the winds and waters play endlessly upon them. Whenever we return, crossing bridges, driving low along the marshes, or taking ferries to reach them, we should always remember that they will always be different, no less than we will be, for time and chance resculpt us all. And so we are always getting acquainted anew with the edge of the sea. Author and naturalist Rachel Carson's Strange and Beautiful Place. No two visits are ever quite the same, no two tide lines ever matching, and the nighttime phosphorescence in the breaking waves and miles of spindrift beneath the moon are the lights of our lives. That very beautifully written article was written by Bland Simpson, the author of The Coasts of Carolina, Seaside to Sound Country, Into the Sound Country, and The Inner Islands. And now the formal pictorial. Ocracoke. Lots of blue in this picture. The ocean is unnaturally blue. The sky is Carolina blue, just gorgeous. And then there's a little strip of land with a lighthouse there and some three-story buildings fronted right on the water and the docks and a nice sailboat floating out here. The village of Ocracoke grew up around Cockle Creek, now Silver Lake Harbor, which continues to be the center of activity on the island. Many native Ocracokers simply call it the creek. Where in the world is Ocracoke? For many mainlanders, the island, accessible only by ferry boat or plane, remains a mystery. For those who live here, it's home to past and present change and stasis, a tight-knit village and wild roots filled with centuries of secrets. Written by Katie Sang-Sing, photographed by Emily Chaplin and Chris Council. Home and Away. The village occupies only about 4 square miles on the southern end of Ocracoke Island. The remaining 13 miles or so are preserved as part of the Cape Hatteras National Seashore, given over to marsh, beach, and maritime forest. Still, residents have the essentials, including a school, a doctor, fire and police departments, a grocery store, even a radio station and a bookstore. For everything else, they hop on a ferry to Hatteras, Swan Quarter, or Cedar Island. Without the bridges that connect most of North Carolina's barrier islands to the mainland, Ocracokers depend on the strength of the bonds within their own community. After the U.S. Navy laid the first paved road in 1942, more roads and cars followed. Drivers now follow North Carolina Highway 12 to ferry docks at either end of the island. But the best way to get around Ocracoke is still by bike, golf cart, or your own 2 feet. Now, this is a double page spread. It's an aerial view of the tip. I see the, what's that place again called? Silver Lake Harbor on the left end, and there's a water tower out there and a couple of long docks extending from some homes, and then there's a big stretch of beach, and it comes out to a little point, and on this side, which would be the open ocean side, I guess, there is a sort of a barrier made of larger boulders or whatever to try to protect that beach and keep it from washing away, I would say. Behind that is just a thicket of forest, fairly low trees. They look all the same kind. We can't really tell what they are from here, this shot from above, and then it's just marshland across the bottom of the picture, which I believe again is the open ocean side here. In the background, you can see the village of Ocracoke, and it's real busy on the left-hand side, and then it fades to all of a sudden fairly nothing as we see very vaguely the road leading up to Hatteras, etc. So there's some few homes and businesses along the road, and then nothing, just the road and the National Seashore. A stay on Ocracoke is a beach vacation with a historical twist. There's boating and beach sitting, of course, as well as banker ponies, supposedly the descendants of Spanish mustangs left by shipwrecked explorers. At 75 feet tall, the 1823 lighthouse is the shortest on the Outer Banks, but it's also the state's oldest still-operating beacon. The 4 graves at the British Cemetery, a patch of Commonwealth land, belong to British Navy personnel aboard the HMT Bedfordshire, sunk by a German U-boat during World War II. Every year in mid-May, a ceremony pays tribute to the crew's sacrifice. This is the end of a picket fence, and somebody has put shells, conch shells and other shells, on each one of the little posts and right here on the end. Down here is one of the ponies looking at us, hoping we're not going to try to touch it or capture it. There's a little stretch of beach here with one family sitting under a red umbrella. We've got a little bit of the seagrass, then the sand, then the waves, and then the ocean extending to the horizon. And here we have two people and a dog in a boat, a Boston Whaler-style boat. I don't know that it is a whaler, but it's really flat bottom boat and square on the front end. And they're out for a sunset ride. A picture down here, a close-up of pink flowers with yellow stamens, the Ocracoke Lighthouse, and the four graves at the British Cemetery. Overleaf, a double spread. Here's the caption first. Springer's Point. Kayaks and sailboats floating on Pamlico Sound echo seafaring vessels of the past. Centuries ago, Native Americans and colonial pilots found refuge on what is now the 122-acre Springer's Point Nature Preserve. In the 1700s, the pirate Edward Teach, a.k.a. Blackbeard, often visited from his home across the Sound in Bath, and fought his final battle on nearby waters, known to this day as Teach's Hole. Now, those who find the near-secret entrance to the preserve, tucked in a neighborhood on Loop Road, hint, hint, follow a sandy path through silvery maritime trees and down to the beach, walking in the footsteps of ponies and pirates. So we're looking from the path across some seagrass, which is about 3 feet high. I don't think I'd want to walk through it and pick up the ticks that are on there. And then a rocky edge to help preserve the coastline. And beyond that, we see a lot of kayakers and one three-masted sailboat. And the sun is setting into a tan and orange sunset at Springer's Point. Here's another picture of Springer's Point. On the coast, places of shelter are precious. The trees at Springer's Point huddle together for protection against battering storms. Within the dome of maritime forest, plants and wildlife flourish. A previous owner of the land, Sam Jones, chose not to develop it, recognizing that he could not improve upon its natural beauty. Today, the Coastal Land Trust ensures that Springer's Point remains untouched and open to the public. For his part, Jones chose to be buried there with his beloved horse, Ikey D, among the ancient live oaks, twisting their knobby arms toward the sun. This is a very twisty tree. The branches come out a long way, and they're so heavy they dip down before they turn and go back up. And there's a couple of people in the water and some watching them. Howard Street is famous. The island's oldest and most famous street remains unpaved. Its sandy ruts established by shells and stones and centuries of foot traffic. Howard Street is still home to members of its namesake family, including Philip Howard and his daughter Amy, and Philip Storr, village craftsman. Philip started the business back in 1970, selling American-made crafts out of a teepee. He also runs a blog to preserve and share Ocracoke history, traditions, and culture. Storytelling runs in the family. Howard lore holds that William Howard, Philip's fifth great-grandfather, who bought the island in 1759 for £105 sterling, served as Blackbeard's quartermaster. Entrepreneurship runs in the family, too. On pleasant days, Amy's 14-year-old son, Lachlan, mans the Howard Street shell shop in his family's yard like a lemonade stand, Ocracoke style. Here's a picture of dad and daughter, and a pretty picture of a white picket fence, a house on the left, and some people walking down the unpaved street. How about the Ocracoke Seafood Company? Every morning around 7 a.m., boats start pulling in behind the fishing of the village fish house, sending schools of Spanish mackerel, bluefish, and cobia sliding down a conveyor belt to be sorted. This used to be a common sight in Ocracoke, but a combination of factors, including regulations, fuel costs, and foreign competition, has endangered the 300-year-old tradition. In 2006, a group of about 30 fishermen and women banded together to save the nonprofit managed by fisherman Hardy Plyer and his wife, Patty, pictured here. Customers can buy the day's catch from Patty in the retail shop up front, then wander to the back to watch the watermen and women work. That connection is vital, the pliers say. When customers can see the boats come in, smell the fish, and hear the stories of folks who work on the water, they understand where their food is coming from, and they know it's real. Here, a man on the left is sorting shrimp into big orange buckets right directly from his boat. And then here's the picture of Ocracoke Seafood with the owners standing on the porch, arms around each other, looking out at us. And the sign says, open. 1718 Brewing. In 2017, nearly 300 years after Blackbeard was killed off the coast of Ocracoke, locals raised a toast to the island's brand new craft brewery, named for the year of the pirate's demise. Garrick and Jacques Calna opened another island gathering place, Ocracoke Coffee Company, in 1996. But Garrick had dreamed of a different kind of brew since he learned to make beer as a college student. So, the couple sold the coffee shop, and now they serve up popular brews like Pepperberry Saison, Brunch, a Coffee Kolsch, and Mexican Chocolate Stout alongside bites from the brewery's in-house restaurant, Plum Point Kitchen. And here are three glasses of the beers, all of different colors. One is very dark brown on the right. One is very clear amber in the center, and the one on the left is a little on the yellowish and not so clear side. And there's a picture shot from above down at the very rustic counter where the beers are sold. And Eduardo's, as a boy growing up in Mexico, Eduardo Chavez learned to cook by his mother's side. He moved to Ocracoke in 2002 and a decade later opened Eduardo's Taco Stand, a little food truck with an outsized following. A steady stream of customers shows what devoted fans and friends already know. Chavez's dishes, traditional recipes passed down from his mother, prepared with local seafood, are made with love. An Overleaf Ballet Folklorico. Over the past two decades, Ocracoke's Hispanic community has grown to compose about 20% of the island's full-time population. In 2016, the arts organization Ocracoke Alive helped start a new tradition. Each November, Festival Latino de Ocracoke celebrates the 31 states of Mexico with food, music, and performances by groups like Ballet Folklorico de Ocracoke. Left to right, Antonio Ortiz wears a costume adorned with roosters to dance Pelea de Gallos from the state of, I can't pronounce it, Aguas Caliente. Of course I can pronounce it. Giselle Perez's China Poblana dress comes from the state of Puebla. Fidelia Villanueva and Amy Ortiz wear their yellow skirts to dance Las Amarillas from the state of Guerrero. And the ladies are very colorfully dressed. Here's the one on the left with white with purple. The one in the middle has lots of red with lots of beads. And the ladies on the right, yellow dresses and white tops. Oh, dear, we have run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I am Fred Brack, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Company, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and this broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Questions, comments? Call us at the studios, 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.